government is not our master, it is our servant. Its only power, that which we the people allow it to have.
Liberty Watch is an independent program on KVOI dedicated to the notion that government remains servant, not master, and operating in the public interest for which the media in this country was designed, by exploring controversy. This helps us to resolve our differences peaceably, refining controversy into clarity through investigation, research, interview of experts, and public feedback. Liberty Watch is based in objective reason and is biased towards individual liberty, and so is not the view of the station or anyone but the host, guests, and callers. Liberty Watch operates outside the realm of political correctness, taking no notice at all of race, creed, religion, ethnicity, political affiliation, or orientation, focusing on content of character in eternal vigilance to the free flow of information about government, technology, current events, and our steadfast Constitution. The program is paid, produced, hosted, and operated by Charles Heller, and any mistakes are solely his responsibility.
Our responsibility. The topic comes up again and again. Today we are blessed to have with us Professor Jonathan Bean. Professor Bean is a professor at Southern Illinois University. At least I think that's what SIU is. It's not certainly not Saturnine Ignoble University. I'm sorry?
I said go Salukis. That's our mascot.
Yeah, right. Oh, so what is a Saluki?
A Saluki is it's the first domesticated dog. It was developed by ancient Egyptians. So if you look, it looks like a very skinny, anorexic animal.
Ah, okay.
That's
sort of an anorexic greyhound.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it.
Oh, what an inauspicious way to start out! But this is a fascinating book, folks. It's called Race and Liberty in America, The Essential Reader, edited by Jonathan Bean. First of all, and on foundation, your book is called Race and Liberty in America. What attracts you to the topic?
Well, you know, there's been a great deal of falsification of history. You know, I'm a college professor. And the first edition of this book came out in 2009, and you know, even at that point, DEI was gaining attraction, critical race theory, but decades earlier than that, you know, the same pernicious ideas that America's history was founded in oppression, white supremacy, and not in the ideals of the Declaration of Independence, which is the first document in my collection. And the Declaration of Independence inspired, you know, just about everybody who followed, from James Fortin, who was a Revolutionary War free black veteran. He's the first contributor after the Declaration, all the way to the present day, with people like Coleman Hughes, Will Riley, and the recent Supreme Court case on affirmative action. So I've taught a course called The Conservative View in U.S. History for 30 years, and in that course I include classical liberalism. So this book is all about trying to recover the classical liberal tradition of civil rights. And that means a focus on individual liberty, the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection, colorblindness, you know, the idea that we should treat others without regard to race. And in all the debates in the book, whether it's about slavery, segregation, Chinese exclusion, FDR's internment of the Japanese, the people who spoke against these things felt that we're all human beings. There's only one human race. In fact, that's what Frederick Douglass, one of the central characters in the book, said. You know, he said, "I can see that there is no division of race. God Almighty made but one race." And yeah. So I dedicated the book to my daughters, my beloved daughters, Joanna and Emily, who are members of the one race that God created. And, you know, my colleagues might think this is like naive, you're ignoring racism and so forth. But all the people in this book, Frederick Douglass included, but many others, they knew what racism was. But they weren't going to let themselves be defined by race, and that was the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where the book steers. It also makes the case that capitalism is not racist. That's a popular idea in higher ed these days. I'm a business historian as well, so I show throughout the book that markets, you know, when they're allowed to operate, were forced to liberate minorities. And there are many, many examples of that.
Can you give one?
Yeah. So James Fortin, the person I just mentioned, he was a free black in Pennsylvania, and he created one of the largest businesses in Philadelphia. He was a sailmaker. I think he had 40 or 50 employees. So this would have been like in the 1810s. The country was still developing. And he had an integrated workforce, which was just a remarkable thing. You know, on the one hand, he's a very conservative, patriotic American. He resisted the pleas of the British to join their cause during the Revolution. He spoke out against racist laws that would have crippled the rights of African Americans in Pennsylvania. You know, but day to day, he ran this business, and he thought that was a great form of uplift. S.B. Fuller was a cosmetics tycoon, African-American who operated out of Chicago but had businessmen and selling his products all over the country is another good example. Or A.G. Gaston. So A.G. Gaston operated in Birmingham, Alabama back in the 50s and 60s when it was probably one of the most racist places in America. And yet he accumulated $150 million, which was extraordinary in the early 1960s. And he helped to bankroll the civil rights movement as well. So these people were, you know, they're businessmen. They're also involved in civil rights, but they believe that we should all hire on merit. S.B. Fuller, the Chicago businessman I just mentioned, he made that point. You know,
is he the guy of the Fuller Brush Company?
No, he had a different company.
Oh, okay.
But it was door-to-door sales as well, just like the Fuller Brush Company. So Louis Tappan was an evangelical Christian businessman, one of the wealthiest people in America in the mid-1800s. And he really set up with his money an entire network of anti-slavery people across the country. And he paid the price. I mean, a mob in New York City where he lived stormed and burned his house. So these people aren't like, silver spooned philanthropists who think they're doing good and not facing down evil.
They were activists.
Right, exactly. Or Branch Rickey. Branch Rickey left St. Louis Cardinals, because blacks couldn't buy tickets, couldn't get seats for St. Louis Cardinals games. And he had an experience as a young baseball player where African-Americans were not allowed to check into the hotel with the rest of the team. And he was a very religious man. He was a Methodist. And he felt that this was violated what Jesus Christ and the New Testament called for. So he moved to Brooklyn, became part owner of the Dodgers. And there's a document in the book that talks about how he saw the recruitment of Jackie Robinson and Jackie Robinson's role as a call from God.
Mm-hmm.
So religion is a theme in the book as well.
I think it's fascinating, and it's neat when people work in the area of their own interest, because then they're driven by passion, not paycheck. Not that there's anything wrong. Not that there's anything wrong with paycheck, but when paycheck follows passion, it makes for a better business. All right, stand by. We're up on our first break, and that was a magnificent answer to that question. I appreciate not only your directness, but also your filling in the blanks in the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios, 520-790-2040. Swap Shop trains are coming. Rolling down that free market track. Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop. Let's listen.
Never give up on the power of the Swap Shop.
Who knows? And I mean, somebody could have had a whole bunch of
old pagers laying around, and they called the swap shop and said, "Can we buy them? We got an order for some pagers. We just need to work on them a little bit first."
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
Hi, it's Mark Levin. Liberty Watch on KVOI is dedicated to the notion that government remains servant, not master. Sounds like Charles has been reading my books. Congratulations on 20 years on KVOI, Charles.
Well, I've got friends in safe spaces. If you don't go with us, then you must be racist. That's our catchphrase. Where's my latte? Come on in and let's get cozy. Showing off participation trophies, watching CNN. Sex faces.
And welcome to Liberty Watch, which is not a safe space. We are more interested in the truth than what's politically correct. In fact, it says that right in the open of the program. We have the joy and pleasure of having with us Professor Jonathan Bean of Southern Illinois University, and he has a wonderful book, which is the book on the table, and this is the second edition of it. It's called Race and Liberty in America, The Essential Reader, edited by Jonathan Bean. And welcome back, and you have stimulated a question from intern Anna. So hang on for just a moment, and your mic is hot. Go for it. Right into the mic.
Hi, Jonathan. I was really fascinated by the topic of your book because it's essentially the whole reason why I myself got into politics. I was kind of tired of hearing constantly that because I am Mexican-American, I am constantly will be naturally disenfranchised because I am not white. And you kind of see this idea propagated in our institutions and our universities. And I was wondering what you thought of after this administration on. Do you think that universities will go back to being places of where ideas are challenged and where that idea will essentially of disenfranchisement of minorities? Will that be continued, or will that stop, or will that continue?
That's a great question. Thank you for the question. Many minorities feel like they should be judged by the content of the character and merit. That's how they're raised. That's what the country's best ideals should strive for.
Yeah.
Things like assimilation have become a dirty word. One of the contributors, Linda Chavez, she has an entry, assimilation is not a dirty word. Doing the things that help people be successful in America are successful because that's the way America works. And America has been a fantastic experiment. And so I'm not surprised at all that minority voters are trending towards the Republican Party. I saw in the New York Times today, of all places, an article about minorities who are disenchanted with DEI and glad that it's going away. So I think that's all great. I have an op-ed on Donald Trump and kind of the strange convergence between what he's doing and what Martin Luther King was aiming for, which was an individual judgment of content of character. But when it comes to the universities, I got to tell you, I've been at this for 30 years now at Southern Illinois University, and before that I was trained at Ohio State University. This is where the problem started with the universities. That's where these ideas like critical race theory, white supremacy explains everything, America is divided between the oppressed and the oppressor. And, those kind of attitudes, they're kind of demeaning of all Americans, including minorities, because they rob you of agency, that you can't do it. You're a victim. And we're a nation of victims. I think the universities are going to be the last bastion, the last resistance. And so there are people who are working against the tide, and that's kind of how I frame it in the second edition. A couple college professors in the second edition David Bernstein. He's got an entry on how we shouldn't classify according to race, all these check boxes that we see. Like, should you check that you're Hispanic, and then you have to check whether you're white or some other race? And so there are many people in the book who say that we should get rid of this checkbox mentality, and that would be a great step forward. Professor Ilya Soman, he's got another entry on immigration. He says that people vote with their feet. Ronald Reagan used to say this, you know. How do we know that communism is a failure? Because people voted with their feet. And Professor Soman argues that immigrants are a good example of that. They improve their circumstances, and they revive the American dream. That's where we should head as a country. But in terms of higher education, I've been fighting battles against political correctness for a number of years. I've gotten outside groups to sue my university, to bring down speech codes. It's a never-ending battle.
Thank God for tenure, huh?
Absolutely. You know, when I got into this business, I had many conservative friends who thought we should get rid of tenure, but I thought, well, I don't know.
Works both ways. Anna, did you have a follow-up question?
Yeah. Do you see college of people that will go to college? Do you see them going to college less because of that? Because of this idea? Because of institutions like that? Because it really, it is like in my family, in my quote unquote culture, this whole idea of that, this new idea of race relations was really odd for us because we've never thought like that. Other families that I've known in my culture, they just never thought like that either. It's different, you know, in my generation, Gen Z. I will see a couple more kids like me think like that. But do you see people going to college less? Kids my age go to college less because of this?
Well, the number of students, I don't know your age, but the typical college student age is 18 to 20.
25.
23, okay.
Oh, she's 25?
Yeah.
Have I known you that long?
Don't ask a woman her age, right?
When below 30, it's okay.
Yes, yes. So, you know, the number of students in that category has been declining, you know, and part of that's demographics. But I'm a director of my school, so I also call prospective students. And the last couple of years, I've got a number of students saying, you know, I don't think I want to go to university. It's not for me. I'm going to go to a trade school. And they do quite well. And I don't know if it's because, you know, I don't ask them about, you know, what they think about universities. But if you come to a university in the last 20 years, I'll take my campus as an example. One of the first things that you'll run into in your dormitory is they will have sensitivity training, and you would have to do a privilege walk. So if you are tall, you have to step forward because that's an example of privilege, and everybody else stays back. If you're white, you have to step forward. If you're a man, you have to step forward. And so on and so forth. If you're disabled, you step back.
Do you lose any points for being short, fat, and white?
I don't know.
Do you give up some of your privilege? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, they have a very cookie cutter, simplistic, binary way of looking at the world. And my campus also sponsors something called Tunnels of Oppression. It was like something out of South Park. You know, I think South Park had an episode that was like this, the Museum of Tolerance. And the kids had to go through this politically correct, absurd or tunnel or hallway. And we've done that here, too, as well. So hopefully there'll be – there's obviously a rollback in red states. I'm in a blue state. We haven't seen any kind of rollback yet. In fact, I think they may double down. Although legally they can be challenged even before Donald Trump became president the second time. Those are great questions.
We have a caller that wants to be on the air. Let's see if I can do this right without knocking you off. And Christopher, go ahead.
Oh, yes. I just tuned in, so I'm assuming this is about white privilege.
Well, it's about the book edited by Professor Jonathan Bean. He's a professor at Southern Illinois University in down in Carbondale. And it's called Race and Liberty in America, The Essential Reader. And he's talking in part about some of the changes that we've seen and some of the ways that President Trump is going back to Martin Luther King and a number of other things, not just white privilege.
Oh, okay. But I just wanted to say, as a 61-year-old white male, I have the privilege of getting up 6 days a week at 3 a.m., walking my dog, and then making breakfast, and then going out and busting my butt doing manual labor daily. And that essentially is what white privilege is to me as a 61-year-old white male in America. And that's my comment.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Professor?
I mean, thank you, Professor.
That's a great. Thank you. You know, Thomas Sowell has an entry in the second edition, and he really, you know, he's such a sharp writer. He's so brilliant. And he takes aim at this whole idea of privilege. And he says, you know, the achievements of individuals are ignored because they happen to be white or they happen to be Asian. And he's always good. He goes back to history and he shows the struggle of, you know, the Irish and Eastern Europeans and others and people today. I mean, the consistent thing that comes through is the achievements of people are not based on race. The Thora Neale Hurston, the great African-American writer from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, very committed to individual liberty, and she says, races have never done anything. What seems race achievement is the work of individuals. And so this, and it goes back to your intern's question. You know, it doesn't matter if you're a minority, if you're a white person. The things that matter are work, merit, self-reliance.
Yeah.
Frederick Douglass gave a speech called Self-Made Men.
Mm-hmm.
He gave this speech almost 100 times in the course of his life, from the 1850s to just before his death in the 1890s. And that was the message that he sent to young African Americans at a time when they were struggling with real white supremacy and racism in the South. But that, he said, in the short term and in the long run, those are the keys to success, that we're all in this together, and everybody else, whatever the race they are, they're going to be judged on how hard they work and how well they take care of themselves.
I have a theory that what some call white privilege is actually American privilege, and that it's mistaken for that, and that you have all these things that are available to you no matter what color you are. And then I don't think that racism is as much what holds people back as the socioeconomic conditions in which they live, which minorities tend to live in lower socioeconomic areas in many cases, especially in the big cities. But that isn't based on race. It's based on socioeconomic condition and how people behave.
Exactly. I mean, you know, clearly there are class differences between groups, but even then, you know, when we start talking about groups, you know, does it make sense, David Bernstein writes in my book, does it make sense to accept the white category of 200 million Americans of all sorts of different backgrounds and national origins and so forth, some very successful, some not so successful? Or black Americans have a lower average incomes than the national average, but there are black immigrant groups are way above white Americans in terms of income and education.
And here,
our Nigerians are great.
And here's a stat that very few people are familiar with. The United States has the most amount of black billionaires in any country in the world.
I believe it.
Yep. All right. Well, one thing where there is absolutely no discrimination, that's our advertisers. We try to run their ads on time. So stand by in the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios. We'll be right back after this with Professor Jonathan Bean of the book Race and Liberty in America, The Essential Reader, now in its second edition.
Thank you for listening to Liberty Watch. Swap shop trains are coming, rolling down that free market track. Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the swap shop. Let's listen.
I wanted to give a big shout out to Arizona Tree. I noticed a saguaro, and it was going to fall right on my well. The biggest arm blew off, and it lost its balance.
Well, so we do support the right of cactus to keep and bear arms.
Swap shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
Hi, it's Dennis Prager. Liberty Watch is dedicated to the notion that government remain servant, not master. Goes very well with my concept of E Pluribus Unum Liberty and in God We Trust. Congratulations on 20 years on KVOI, Charles.
Coca-Cola's done lost their dadgum minds. Yeah, the white guilt's hitting pretty hard this time. I thought I'd seen it all, but as it turns out, I have to change my skin to live this one down. We gotta be less white, be less white. These liberals gone wild and they lost their minds. We gotta be less white, be less white. Now I'm switching to Pepsi and it's all alright.
And no more Woca-Cola for him. And in the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios at KVOI, and we have the joy and pleasure of having with us Professor Jonathan Bean. His book is Race and Liberty in America, The Essential Reader, now in its second edition, first out in 2009, now out again in 2025. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but at this point, intern Anna has another question. Go for it.
Yeah, so how have books like Ibram X. Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist and Rahman DiAngelo's White Fragility have added to the problem? I wonder where they're going to get their money after this in the next few years, because I don't know who's going to pay them anymore. And we're going to see a cultural shift, but how have they added to the problem?
If listeners probably would not enjoy reading Ibram Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist or Rahman DiAngelo's White Fragility, but their books had such a pernicious influence, particularly since the late 2010s, and then with George Floyd and Black Lives Matter 2020. You know, the great irony is that their message is that whites can't handle the truth, whites are irredeemably racist, and yet it's guilt-stricken white liberals who are buying their books, and corporations are assigning them as resources. But I think the tide has turned. I mean, those books are really insulting to the intelligence. They're self-contradictory. And they reinforce the things that people are now rebelling against, which is just being always on the guard for saying the wrong thing. And so I think sensitivity training, we're going to see a real correction. Ibram Kendi and Rahman DiAngelo fed into this sensitivity training through diversity bureaucracy, and I think that's going to change. And there's people like Chloe Valdery, who's got an alternative form of getting people together, whether it's workers or students. She calls it the theory of enchantment. Another woman has something called the Moral Courage Network. The whole idea is to get people together, and you show how you disagree on some things, but that you have much in common. And there's no wrong answer. And that's really the way universities should operate. And every space should be a free space, not necessarily a safe space. And so I really am encouraged by seeing these alternatives to the kind of a neo-racist, stereotype-based training that was influenced by Ibram Kendi's book and Rahman DiAngelo's book as well.
How about we have training on the First Amendment?
Oh, amen.
You know, that's what I think. That's sometimes what we need remedial training in. I'll never forget, I was standing at the Pima County Fairgrounds giving out some leaflets, standing off the pavement before near a gun show. I was a vendor at the gun show, and people were walking past in the entrance line, and I was handing them leaflets. And hold on, caller, I'll be right with you. And I was handing them leaflets. And the fairgrounds people came up to me and said, you can't do that. And I said, why not? They said, you can't hand out leaflets here. I said, this is public property. I paid to be here. I paid to park here. And this is a pure First Amendment activity. Leafleting was definitely thought of when the First Amendment was written.
Mm-hmm.
Her response was, well, this is Pima County, sir. We'll see about that. I said, we sure will. If you don't get out of my face, I'm calling the police. And I did. And but, you know, how do you be an official of a government and not know that the First Amendment covers leafleting, providing you're not interfering?
Yeah, well, you know, people act on their prejudices. They always have. And now there's this new idea that, you know, some types of speech don't deserve the First Amendment protections because they're hateful or insensitive or are doing some sort of harm to other people, however, you know, amorphous and indirect that is. And, you know, universities, corporations as well, sometimes, if they have government contracts, may be challenged under the current administration if they violate First Amendment rights. And compelled speech. I mean, a lot of employees have to write up diversity statements, you know, which are akin to loyalty oaths. And there's challenges to that in some of the state universities, starting in California. But this shouldn't be a requirement. You can't require people to do, say, the Pledge of Allegiance in school if it violates their conscience. And you shouldn't compel speech when it comes to a person's job, particularly if they're working for a state institution.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like Congress shall establish no religion nor interfere with the free exercise thereof. Make no law establishing religion nor prohibit the free exercise thereof. People forget about the free exercise thereof clause, and I forgot about the caller. Hold on a second. Caller, your first name, please.
My name is Mike.
Mike, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. This is a fascinating subject, and I appreciate you booking this gentleman that is obviously quite intelligent. So my question to you, sir, if Donald Trump eliminates the Department of Education, how do you think it's going to affect colleges and states as far as the education process? And then finally, is it going to affect this this sickness, this DEI stuff and all this stuff going on? Can you please
What a great question.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm old enough to remember the election of 1980 when Ronald Reagan said he was going to get rid of the Department of Education, and here we are 45 years later. And perhaps Donald Trump will carry through on what Ronald Reagan wanted to do in 1980. You know, I don't know how soon that would have an effect on college campuses. Obviously, some things are still backed by statute. And have to be carried out by whatever body replaces the Department of Education. But I will say this. I mean, universities have to deal with just this incredible bureaucracy and this nonsense that we have to fill out forms. We're constantly having to create assessment reports mandated by the Department of Education or mandated by the accrediting body that is sponsored by the Department of Education. Even my liberal colleagues, you know, they really have nothing good to say about this. DEI, some of it comes from the federal government. A lot of it comes from universities themselves, though, including private schools, which would be exempt from any kind of federal intervention. So I think there's a cultural problem. I think that's the primary problem, is that universities have been taken over by a class of people that view things through a very narrow racial lens. And frankly, they don't know their history. They think they do. They certainly don't know the history that's in Race and Liberty in America, the Essential Reader.
Isn't Linda McMahon the nominee to be the education secretary?
I believe so.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Then that tells you what they'll replace the Department of Education with. It'll be the World Wrestling Federation instead. The Department of Wrestling.
Yeah, well, they say it's a circus, so here we are.
Oh, thank you. You just gave me a promo for my show. You're going to be famous.
These are great questions. I love your listeners' questions, and I love the fact that your radio show is community individual liberty, and that's what the book is all about.
Right, and also I'm also committed to andiatura et alterna pars, let the other side be heard. I've had people here who, frankly, had idiotic points of view. I bring them on to let the audience see the idiocy. I'm not referring
Absolutely.
To you. But I'm if people wish to self-immolate, I'm not going to provide any gasoline. Okay, that's up to them. But I'm also not standing by with a fire extinguisher either. That's freedom.
Right.
You know, that's my definition of freedom. So just for God's sake. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, the way I teach is, you know, students have to be exposed to opposing viewpoints.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, the course on American conservatism, they see that, you know, what is conservative or libertarian has changed over time, and they were, you know, often debating each other, dating people that weren't conservatives. Another course on the history of socialism, you know, we start with Karl Marx and others, and we go right up through Gulag Archipelago and the robust discussions. The students all have different perspectives on these documents.
You just say Gulag Archipelago because you can't pronounce Solzhenitsyn.
Oh, yes. Alexander Solzhenitsyn was we used to share the same state. I'm a native of Vermont, and when he left the Soviet Union, he settled in Vermont.
Well, he wanted a familiar climate. All right, stand by in the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios. We'll be right back with Professor Jonathan Bean.
You know, the exchange of ideas is so important to maintain our freedom in this country. And Liberty Watch is a show that promotes freedom.
Cancel culture runs the world now, the planet went crazy. Label everything we say as homophobic or racist. If you're white, then you're privileged, guilty by association. All our childhood heroes got Me Too'd or they're rapists.
They never freed the slaves. They realized that they don't need the chains. They gave us tiny screens. We think we free because we can't see the cage. They knew that race war would be the game they need to play. For people to big teams, they use the media to feed the flame.
Fake woke, they won't tell me what to believe.
And welcome back to the last segment of Liberty Watch today with Professor Jonathan Bean. The book on the table is the second edition of Race and Liberty in America, The Essential Reader. It's got some very good, very, very good commentary from a number of people, including one article from Professor Bean himself. What I try to make the music match the interview, so Fake Woke is the name of that song. And, you know, do you ever, like, collect music that agrees with your point of view and play it for people?
Oh, that's a good point. I'm trying to think. You mean, like, my political point of view?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm trying to think of some songs at the time.
That's okay. Well, that one's called Fake Woke.
Fake Woke. Tom Sawyer, Rush. Tom Sawyer would be a good song. Probably agrees.
Okay.
Agrees with my viewpoint, yeah.
And so I would encourage you in your teaching, not that I should tell a PhD what he ought to be teaching, but I would encourage you that music is a really wonderful way to communicate a point. I got to tell you, there is a wonderful song about thinking for yourself. Did you like Harry Chapin's music?
Yes.
Harry Chapin has a song called Flowers Are Red, and it's about a kid who comes to school in first grade, and he's painting flowers in all the colors of the rainbow, and his teacher's saying, "What are you doing?" And he says, I'm painting all the colors of the rainbow. And the teacher says, "Everybody knows that flowers are green and red," and stands them in the corner. By the end of the year, his creativity's gone. And he goes to another school, and he's painting flowers in neat rows of green and red. And it's just a wonderful song that makes a point in song about smashing people's creativity. And frankly, about political correctness. It's called Flowers Are Red. I encourage you to look that up.
I'll look that up.
Yeah. Music is another language of communication. My grandfather said every language you learn is another window to the world. And I think that's just another window. Going back to your book, which is the topic of today's interview, Wilfred Riley argues that reparations are a bad idea and that there's three questions that wreck it, which is who gets, who pays, and who's next. and it makes them unworkable. And Riley notes the problem is racial classification. What is a black person? I don't think you better ask Ketanji Brown Jackson because she's not a biologist. But
Well, Riley, Wilfred Riley, is a former student of mine. He, even when he was here at Southern Illinois University, he's just brilliant. And his essay is worth the price of admission for this book because I think of anybody in the book is going to grab a reader, it's Will Riley. He just writes wonderfully and just in a very colorful way. And he says, forget about all the moral objections to reparations. Reparations won't work because it has to deal with three questions. Who gets, who pays, and who's next? And so who gets is your question. You know, is it going to go to black Americans? Okay, what about black immigrants? What about blacks who are already successful? Who pays? You know, the people whose ancestors fought in the Civil War to end slavery, should they pay? Should people, recent immigrants, pay? Whether they're white, Asian, Arab, or whatnot. And then who's next? I mean, the logic of reparations, it really has no end. You know? So if you give it to the descendants of black slaves in America, what about American Indians? What about poor whites in Appalachia? He actually teaches at a historically black college in Appalachia, so he knows the kind of feudal oppression that poor whites had to deal with. And he says the reparations advocates, they come up with numbers that it's like they were dreamed up by daydreaming children. I've got an op-ed on this in the about California and San Francisco. San Francisco wants to give $5 million to every African-American who lives in San Francisco or was a victim of the drug war anywhere in the country. So that's $5 million to start, and then $100,000 a year for the next 250 years. I mean, it's just ludicrous.
No, that's a black rapper.
Yes, absolutely.
But, yeah. At least you know I was listening. It strains credulity to the point of where you have to say that there used to be an old saw about the person who killed his parents and threw himself at the mercy of the court because he was an orphan, but then the Menendez brothers did that.
Yeah. So I think, you know, reparations looks like it was gaining traction after 2020, George Floyd, Black Lives Matter, Democratic candidates, including Kamala Harris, said they were open to the idea. Fortunately, it hasn't moved forward. You know, it's a bad idea. It's unworkable. And it would really just destroy the country.
Professor Bean, I got to lovingly disagree with you. I think you're looking at this from the wrong end of the telescope. I think Netanyahu ought to demand reparations from Egypt.
Ah.
I mean, there's a documented history of slavery
there. Why limit it to America? We can move around the world.
Right. Well, you know, let's spread the wealth. Right?
Yep, absolutely.
Why does it seem, maybe it's just fear, false evidence appearing real, but why does it seem that Marxism seems to pick up in sales for a while every time it gets rebranded?
Yeah, you know, I think there's Thomas Sowell has a book called The Conflict of Visions, and he says, you know, there's two types of people explain, you know, most ideologies. One is the constrained vision, and that's people that believe that they don't have all the knowledge in the world and they don't know all the consequences of whatever action they're going to propose. So they, you know, they're humble. There's a certain humility there and a skepticism about anybody who's setting out to plan society, including themselves. And then there's the unconstrained vision, which sees some ideal good. It's usually equality of outcomes, which is the Marxist creed. And then it's like the third wave anti-racist creed and so forth. And they don't care about the consequences. They see only good coming from their actions. And it's one of Thomas Sowell's more philosophical books, but I think he's on to something there.
One of the first classes I took in college, and I did not matriculate. I've been very successful at avoiding matriculation in several institutions of higher learning. And one of the first classes I took was Speech 101, with Professor Gary Davis, and I couldn't think of his last name for years, but I learned so much about the way to frame something from that, about if-then statements and universal statements and such. And it gave me a perspective through which to see all communication. I wonder if there isn't some way to make everybody see that.
Yeah, you know, courses like that, or courses like logic,
right,
which used to be required of all college students.
Well, that was part of speech. Logic was part of speech.
Right, right. It could be part of speech. It could be, when I was an undergraduate in the early 80s, it was its own course. Those are no longer required. Now we have hundreds of courses at institutions like mine that you can choose for your general education requirements. And it can be like really niche things on, you know, queer literature or, you know, environmental justice. Or, I mean, these are not the things that everybody needs to know. It's just kind of a cafeteria approach. And so if we could get back to the basics, like your example, speech or logic, you know, we'd be in a better place because people have a similar understanding of some, you know, basic foundations of thinking.
How about reasoning from cause to effect? Simple logic.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what the teaching of history is all about. So,
explain that remark. Go into that a little bit in the next minute and a half.
Well, so, you know, there's the first level of history, which is just, it's a bunch of memorizing facts. But then we want students to understand, okay, what caused this event? It could be the American Revolution. What were the effects? And then as they do that, make them aware that everything has multi-causality. There's multiple causes. The effects aren't going to always be as intended. And so they come away, if they do this again and again and again through their history classes and reading and writing, to understand that history is nuanced and complex, and don't try to simplify it to make life easy for yourself.
So reducing something to its lowest common denominator is not always the best way to figure it out.
No, I mean, you could feel that history is important things like individual liberty and struggle against power, When you study particular events, you got to be attentive to everything surrounding those events. And so, yes, that's a good approach, I think.
Teaching how to think, not what to think. There's a concept.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Professor Bean, I appreciate your sharing this hour with us. Once again, folks, the book is Race and Liberty in America, The Essential Reader. Thank you for sharing this with us, and it's worth getting it. Where do you want people to get the book?
They can get it on Amazon, or they can get it at independent.org.
Independent.org. I would much rather buy through an organization like that than I would through Amazon. Not that I dislike Jeff Bezos, but why not empower the organization, the Independent Institute, which helps sponsor people like you.
Yes. Thank you for having me, Charles.
My pleasure. Enjoy. And that clears the lines, and also it